This is Nancy Clare, and welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This week my guest is M.O. Walsh, whose first novel, My Sunshine Away, is scheduled for publication tomorrow, February 10th, 2015. My Sunshine Away is a bit of a departure for Speaking of Mysteries. The catalyst for the story is a crime that takes place, but the course of the novel, which is written in the form of a memoir, is more about making sense of what happened in the wake of that crime, which was the rape of a young girl. In that respect, it's perhaps more about the examination of a crime's impact than the search for a solution. That's not to say that along the way there aren't revelations about the characters involved. There are. And although we usually talk about mysteries and thrillers, talking to a writer about an incredibly satisfying story is always a pleasure. Here is Neil Walsh to talk about My Sunshine Away. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. My guest this week is M.O. Walsh, who is known as Neil. My Sunshine Away is a unique book. It is not a traditional crime novel, although the story would not be the story without a crime that's committed. Would you consider that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I never, you know, when I sat down to write it, I never conceived of it as a crime novel. I thought of it as, you know, I was just thinking of the character and a crime, you know, did occur that kind of, you know, spun things into motion. But I never really conceived it as in terms of genre as a crime novel or even a mystery, really. I was just trying to get into the story and get into the characters.
Well, it's written as a memoir by an unnamed narrator. And even though we don't know his name, we can certainly feel his struggle with the territory between memory and facts. In fact, mm-hmm. the book is an effort for him to marshal his memories in such a way as to what happened to Lindy, one of the central characters, and to his family can make some sort of sense. Do you think that happens? Does he make sense? And can this memoir help him make sense of the past?
I think so. I mean, at least to me, you know, sitting down with it, that was kind of the driving force of, you know, the reason for why he's telling this story and who he's telling it to is a real attempt and effort on his part to, you know, to, I guess, own up to some of the things he's done in his life, to situate, you know, who he was in the past with who he is now, the try to take ownership of, you know, the way that he can conduct himself in the future to be perhaps more like a person he would like to be. And then also, you know, coming to terms with the fact that there's things in our past that we can't fix, you know. I think that's part of the struggle that everyone has. I mean, I think that we all, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, but I know personally for myself, you know, when something goes wrong, you want to go back and just fix it. And some things you can go back and fix, but a lot of things you can't. And getting square with that, I think, is a struggle for a lot of people.
The story takes place in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and you do an interesting thing towards the end of the book where you go through the Baton Rouge is not New Orleans, and and I thought that was actually pretty funny. But the family in the center of the story, the narrator's family, is Catholic, which I think a large percentage of people in Louisiana are. And all through the book, mm-hmm. I kept thinking about the sins of commission and omission. And was that something that you had in mind as you wrote the book?
I don't think so. As far as I think you'd be surprised at how little I had in mind as I wrote it. Other than trying to get one good sentence I was happy with, and then another good sentence, and you know, then a paragraph. You know, for me it was. I think any of the kind of larger designs that I see or that we can see in the book now are more of a result of a kind of, almost, micro anxiety about, making sure characters are, earnest and true, and making sure the sentences are good. I think the larger designs kind of come out of that, and once you have characters that they're real to you, and you understand, their motivations and why they would react certain ways and hope certain things. I think a lot of the larger stuff just kind of falls in place because of that, if that makes sense.
I thought the characters were very real, and I think a lot of people reading this book, no matter where they were brought up, will identify with the sort of neighborhood archetypes, which are actually never cardboard cutouts. I mean, they're all fully formed human beings. And you must have drawn on some of your experiences with the neighbors and people you knew, and even perhaps members of your family, in drawing some of these characters and making them so fully formed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would imagine that most people do when they write. They're drawing on those folks that they've known. I mean, I think that something that's pretty typical is taking someone you've known that you found interesting and just kind of really turning the dials up on them in different ways. I mean, maybe really exaggerating a certain part of their personality, or maybe combining the personalities of people you found kind of fascinating. I guess to me that's one of the ways I look at character and making sure, and hope, trying to make sure that they're, like you said, they're not cardboard cutouts. I mean, every character is multifaceted, even if they're not the main character. And I think this is the type of book where the narrators had plenty of time to think about these people. By the time you're telling the story, the narrator's talking about, the late 1980s and early 90s, but he's doing it, from now. I mean, he's in his 30s now, so he's had a lot of time to really consider these people. So, it's not like you're telling a story talking about a story that happened last week, instead he's able to kind of think about who the character was then at the moment that he's talking about them, and maybe what's happened in their lives in the, decades since then. So I think that's helpful in terms of building character, having that retrospection.
Well, it wouldn't really be a story unless there were unintended consequences. That seems to be the genesis of most stories. And in My Sunshine Away, everything changed in one night. But am I right in thinking, at least from the narrator's perception, perhaps unconsciously, the street's residents resisted letting the change take over? There was a push-pull between acknowledging what happened and wishing it would all just go away.
I think so. Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, there's, I think with the point in time in the narrator and in the characters' lives when this happened, when they were young, I think it's, this is the rape of a young girl. And it was, I think, incredibly, obviously, on the surface of it, traumatic, but also, intensely confusing and obscure to people who have not, who are that age and don't quite understand the future and what that means, and how it can change a person and change even the way not just change a person, but change a family and change an outlook on humanity. I mean, the way that people look at their fellow humans and what we're capable of. I mean, it has ramifications that you don't recognize, when you're young. And so I think that a lot of the book is, like you're saying, there's a certain urge on everyone's part to kind of push it away and hope that it'll go away kind of on its own. And then there's, the other realization that comes later, which is dealing with it. And like I mentioned earlier, coming to face the reality that some things can't just be tidied up, and so I do think that there is that kind of a tension between the, like you said, a kind of push and pull throughout the book in terms of dealing with it.
Well, one of the things that I really enjoyed as I read it was it seems as if the residents of the street and the families were trying to move along in the same direction, and no one would admit that just under the surface the train was off the track. And I found that just so interesting in watching the narrator come to grips with that and in the story, and sort of he could see where the cracks were that were happening. Mm-hmm. But he was a kid and there wasn't a lot he could do except go along for the ride. And yet you didn't make him seem helpless. You made, you know, he seemed as empowered as a teenage boy could possibly be.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And I think it's a lot of, speaking to your first point, you know, a lot of the book is, you know, takes place in a kind of nice suburban neighborhood, which is very much the kind of American, you know, dream type of scenario at the time. And so I think there is a lot of reluctance, you know, for families and people living in that type of situation to, and, you know, he's going to private school and all that type of stuff. And there's a reluctance for people to say that things could be wrong, because how could something be wrong when we've done everything right, you know, according to the, you know, what we thought we were supposed to do in order to live in this comfy house and have this, you know, glowing swimming pool. I think there is reluctance, you know, there to that point. As far as, you know, him being empowered, you know, that was, to me, it's, you know, teenagers is, I mean, part of the whole thing about being a teenager is trying to find little pockets of life that you can actually control, because there are so few, you know. I mean, you can't drive, you know, you can't, but there's so many things you can't do yet. You just feel like you're constantly under someone's thumb, and so, you know, a lot of, you know, for a lot of teenagers, that's, you know, when drugs come around and things like that, you're just trying to find anything you can control in your own life. And so some of the scenes in the book that I really enjoyed the most are, there's a scene where he's where he gets to play guitar at a house party, which seems like not a big deal. But, you know, any kid who's ever, like, you know, cranked the amplifier all the way up in front of people is feeling pretty good, you know. And so there's little moments like that I really enjoyed, when he was kind of gaining some power and some agency in his own life, and since so many things in his life are totally out of his control, like you mentioned.
Well, he has a fraught relationship with his father. His parents are divorced, mm-hmm. and a distant relationship with his two sisters, who are much older than he is. And although it's, mm-hmm. it's never mentioned in the book, it seems like he's sort of a surprise baby, mm-hmm. you know, coming 10 years after the next oldest sibling.
Right.
But one of the things, as I read it, I mean, it's a very adult novel, and it is, certainly deals with adult themes. And as you said, it challenges us to evaluate our pasts and the things we could have changed and how our pasts made us who we are today. But I kept thinking that this would be a good book for a young adult, someone who was 16 or 17 years old, right through college age. It seemed like there would be a lot they could identify. Was that one of the audiences you were thinking about when you wrote the book? One of the readerships, I should say.
You know, not, I mean, really, no. You know, it's funny. It's been funny to me because it's been described that way to me as well. Like, you know, well, this would be a great, I just heard this term for the first time last Friday, a great YA crossover. And I heard someone saying that. I was like, what? What, you know, what do you mean? Well, YA? I don't think of it that way. I think I just don't understand the term very well, you know. And they're like, no, YA crossover is kind of like that older, you know, YA, like you're saying, 16, 17, you know, moving up. And when I think about it in terms of that, I think it'd be wonderful if someone of that age could find something that resonated with them. Because that's a tough age, you know. And, you know, like, you know, obviously a lot of the book takes place when the character is around that age. So yeah, if they found something there, that'd be wonderful to me. It was never, like I was mentioning earlier, you know, I didn't really have any intentions other than just trying to tell the story the best that I could. I didn't really have any sort of, you know, only readers I ever have in mind are like other writers who I respect and like, would they think it stinks or not? You know, that's kind of my readership. It's like, you know, with someone that I think is a good writer, where they turn their nose up at it, I wouldn't want that to happen. So that's really all I think about in terms of that.
Those of us in the West and all around the country hear a lot about Southern literature, and I kind of struggle with that as an identifier. But I was wondering, do you consider My Sunshine Away to be a Southern book specifically? Maybe something that couldn't have been written if you lived in Minnesota or Wyoming?
I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems like there's kind of two parts to that question. One being the idea of this, of this Southern writer and the sort of like tradition, that you're entering into and all that type of stuff, which, I hear about here as well. And I like tons of Southern authors, and I've read that stuff almost my whole life. And that's, the writers I've studied under, a lot of them were Southern writers, Barry Hannah and Tom Franklin and people like that who people consider Southern writers. But, any story can be told from anywhere, right? So I don't, in answer to the second question, could it happen anywhere? I think yes, the plot obviously could. I would say the difference for me, at least with this book, is that I see a lot of it really tied to Louisiana and tied to the, I don't know, there's an urge I think that the narrator has to defend Baton Rouge, where he's from, to defend Louisiana and the South from misinterpretation, because I think that's part of a big part of what he's afraid of too, in the telling of his story and his his role in what happened to Lindy. And I think I think a lot of the story is you need to hear me out. It's not as simple as you think, and just because you hear this one detail, don't make up the rest of the story until I've told you, if that makes sense. There are whole chapters in the book, I think, where he's trying to explain Baton Rouge a little bit, trying to explain the South, trying to say it's not all just swamps and alligators, and
although it is like hot.
It's hot. It's hot for sure. And there are swamps and there are alligators. That's not what it's all about. I do think that absolutely the plot could exist and all that stuff could exist. But for me, there was something really intertwined between his telling and the South and the place he's from, I can understand the saying you have difficulty with that kind of Southern literature as an identifier. All human dramas can happen anywhere, and there's great storytellers from every inch of this country. But there's something about about it, whether it be I don't know, the setting or the heat or the pacing or the cadence or something that people seem to quantify as a Southern. I wouldn't know. I never sit down and say I'm going to write a Southern story. I just sit down and the place that I know is Louisiana, so it's usually where I set it, and everything else that comes out of that is just it's just lots of times just luck if it works out.
Well, I personally think it did work out, but like I said, this was a story of a young man in a sort of middle class, upper middle class, suburban neighborhood, and I could see this, with the exception of the Spanish Moss, I could see it happening almost anywhere, which gave it a universal.
Right.
To me, it gave it a universal story, but it was the juxtaposition of the South, because it was very much taking place in Baton Rouge. I thought your explanation of what happens when there's a football game at LSU was great. I mean, you really, even though the story was universal and that could have been any street almost anywhere, you firmly put it in its geography of Baton Rouge. And I enjoyed that, never because
well, that's right. Yeah. Thank you.
As you pointed out, most people that go to Louisiana don't go to Baton Rouge.
Yep, that's true.
They go to, you know, New Orleans and maybe Lake Pontchartrain, and and then they said they've been to Louisiana. So
yeah, absolutely.
I want to change it up a little bit. All the time I was reading the book, the lyrics from Sarah McLachlan's "Building a Mystery" kept playing in my head, and there are musical allusions referenced in the book. And I like to ask this of writers, were there any particular songs that inform the story? Were there songs that you had listened to? I know that the narrator plays "Sweet Child of Mine" at the party that you referenced earlier. But was there any music that influenced you in defining the characters?
Not really. I mean, other than the obvious example of the title, you know, I mean, the title song, "You Are My Sunshine," to me, it's kind of, in a strange way, kind of like the structure for the novel is that song. It's the state song of Louisiana, and it's a lot of, you know, when you grow up as a kid, you learn to sing that song like in kindergarten, and when you hear a bunch of kids singing it, it sounds so happy, and it's like, oh, it just reminds you of your youth. But then you go and you actually like listen to the actual verses of the song, and it's enormously kind of sad song. There's like a lot of loss and anxiety and all this stuff in the verses, and that to me was always just really important because I feel, at least I hope, that the book is doing something like that, like recognizing that lots of times we look back at our past through this really kind of nostalgic view, but then when we look at the details. Look at the verses. There's a lot of troubling stuff there. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of sadness. So that song, I think, was, you know, hugely important. But other than that, not really. I love music. I play a little horrible guitar on my own sometimes and things like that. I love to sing and all that. But I didn't really have, I'm not one of those people that, you know, always has certain songs they play when they're writing certain stories or certain moods. I've just never really done that. I need actually just total silence, which is hard to come by in a house with two kids. You know? any decent writing I ever do is typically like between 4 in the morning and 6 in the morning before everybody gets up, you know. I didn't really have any songs that informed it in that way.
With the exception of the title. I should have mentioned the song that you title of the book. Are you working on your next novel?
No, I haven't started. I've got a couple of ideas that are, you know, kind of ill-formed, and I'm sure doomed to failure. But right now I'm actually still kind of working on this book in lots of ways, and, you know, like writing little essays and, doing interviews and all that type of stuff. So a lot of my time is still with this book, which, you know, happily, but I've not yet ventured into a new novel. I think writing this one, you know, this one took me 7 years to do. I think I recognize now it's quite it. You know, if you're going to jump into something, it should hopefully be a good idea. So I'm trying to get one of those. You know, I had a couple of novels I started before this one that, you know, I would spend several months on and get 100 pages into and realize it was just totally flawed and awful idea. And so I'm kind of being a little bit more careful, this time, and working on some stories that I kind of abandoned, you know, when I was doing the novel, and kind of tidying some old stuff up. So I haven't ventured into a new novel yet, but I'm looking forward to it. It's quite an addictive feeling to finish something that you've been working on for so long, you know?
I can only imagine.
Yeah. It's a huge commitment, but that's, you know, that's part of the joy of it. I mean, like being a parent, you know, it's like the hardest thing that I've ever done. I mean, definitely the most mentally challenging. It definitely gives you the most excuses to stop, you know. It's like, why don't you just stop? Don't you realize this is really hard? You can stop anytime you want. No one's going to care. It's a challenge, you know, and it's once I've, you know, finishing it, was just an enormous, pleasure. It was just, I don't know. I can understand the addictive quality of it in terms of, you know, once people kind of write novels, they kind of keep going back to it. Because it was quite an experience.
Well, it was wonderful.
You know, make it. Well, yeah. You know, thanks. I was just gonna say it's a weird experience to, like, you know, to make a decision with a character, you know, when you are 25 years old, and then, you know, when you're 31, you realize you have to deal with that decision you made hundreds of pages before, you know, when you were a totally different person, and your life is so different. It's pretty wild. It's interesting. It's, like I said, the most, intellectually and mentally exhilarating thing I've done.
Well, it was a joy to read, and definitely an unusual book. And I'm sorry we couldn't speak more specifically about what goes on in the book, but that would spoil it for everybody.
That's right. Yeah, we don't want to do that.
So, I appreciate your time and talking to us about this book. Thank you again for your time, Neil Walsh, and who's written My Sunshine Away.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Next week, our guest is Jo Perry, who's going to talk about her first mystery and first novel, Dead is Better. It's really a unique story, and I'm looking forward to talking to her about it. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.